week on the Best of Flashpoints, National Lawyers Guild President Marjorie Cohn commenting on the newly released Justice Department documents that further implicate Bush legal officials, including John Yoo, in a wide-ranging program of torture. Power Shift, an unprecedented protest in Washington, D.C., with thousands of students calling for decisive action to turn the tide on climate change. And an in-depth report on Saturday's march against the racist and brutal policies of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Phoenix, Arizona, including interviews with local indigenous leaders and Zach De La Roca of Rage Against the Machine. Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barros Friedman, and Miguel Gavilan Molina are coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Yesterday, the Justice Department released 9 national security legal opinions written by the Bush administration, which revealed that in the weeks before President George W. Bush left office, an administration attorney had disavowed all of the decisions apparently made after 9/11 in the context, eventually, of the Patriot Act. Joining us to talk about the significance of these new memos and what they all have to do with a man by the name of John Yoo is our good friend Marjorie Cohn. She is the president of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the soon-to-be-released Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Flashpoints.
My pleasure, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you again. First of all, give us a brief thumbnail sketch of what the new memos mean and suggest.
Well, it's quite amazing. I mean, we had seen some of the prior memos, the John Yoo, Jay Bybee memos, where they purported to basically insulate the Bush administration from any prosecution for torture, redefining torture. But these memos go even further in many respects. John Yoo, who is the author or co-author of some of these memos, and Jay Bybee, a federal court judge, also author of one or more of these memos, talk about things like the Fourth Amendment won't apply to any domestic military operations. In other words, if the president thinks that there's a terrorist in a house in the United States, even a U.S. citizen, he can authorize the police to just barge in, or the military to barge in and with guns blazing and search and seize and arrest people without even going to a judge. In other words, the Fourth Amendment wouldn't apply. There's also another astounding assertion in one of these memos where John Yoo, who is one of the co-authors of the memo, it was dated October 23rd, 2001, suggested that the president could even suspend the Fourth Amendment, freedom of speech and freedom of press, if he thought it was necessary to wage the so-called war on terror. And you wrote, First Amendment speech and press rights may also be subordinated to the overriding need to wage war successfully. In that memo, John Yoo essentially said that the United States was in a state of armed conflict, and he said the scale of violence was unprecedented, legal and constitutional rules governing law enforcement, such as the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures, didn't apply. Another one of the memos, one written by Jay Bybee, the federal court judge, now of course rewarded for his role in these memos with a plum spot on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, was dated March 13, 2002, and it basically gives the green light to extraordinary rendition. He concluded that the president can transfer al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners anywhere, to any country they want, and as long as they don't intend that the person be tortured in that third country, then there's no restriction. He says the torture convention doesn't apply, and we know from speaking before, Dennis, that the torture convention says that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. But the torture convention also says that no country can expel, return, or extradite a person to another country where there are substantial grounds for believing that he would be in danger of being subjected to torture. Jay Bybee writes in this March 13, 2002 memo that the torture convention doesn't apply extraterritorially, which is an astounding assertion. So this was one, and then what happened, and there are many other, there are too many egregious things to go over in the short amount of time we had, but one of the things that John Yu and his co-author Delahunty did was to say that, because the law recognizes self-defense, legitimate self-defense, therefore the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. because we're basically defending ourselves against these people who are attacking us in the country right now in this state of war. Now, it is true that we had terrorist attacks, horrific attacks on 9/11 that killed 3,000 people in New York and in Pennsylvania. But nobody, I think, in their right mind would say that we are in a state of war. And so he's saying because we have a right to self-defense, then we can suspend the Fourth Amendment because we're defending ourselves against the terrorists. Now, that's the same kind of reasoning that Bush used with his preemptive war strategy, saying, we're acting in self-defense here by going into Iraq and Afghanistan. The law of self-defense, and I know because I teach criminal law, requires that there be a reason, the person exercising self-defense have a reasonable belief in the need to defend against death or imminent death or great bodily injury. And there's no showing that the terrorists are imminently going to attack us. So, I mean, these memos basically inform the Bush administration that there are no limits at all on the president in suspending the Constitution. Now, interestingly, a couple of months before Bush left office, this was on October 6th, 2008, and then again on January 15th, 2009, the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice issued two memos basically rescinding all of these prior memos, saying we didn't really mean it, we weren't really following them anyway, and it was the classic cover your ass, excuse my French, classic, saying, well, the legal reasoning, and it not really criticizing the legal reasoning, but saying for various reasons, we shouldn't rely on them, disavowing them. Now, I believe we've talked before about the two infamous torture memos that John Yu wrote or co-wrote. One was on August 1st, 2002, the other on March 14th, 2003. And in those two memos, John Yu redefined torture far more narrowly than our law permits, saying that the person had to basically suffer something akin to organ failure in order to be tortured, and talking about how the president and how officials could get away with torture and not be charged under the War Crimes Act because they would be acting in self-defense or out of necessity, notwithstanding the absolute prohibition on torture, which I read earlier. Now, after this August 1st, 2002 memo was public, the Department of Justice knew that it was indefensible. It was bad PR. So On June 1st, 2004, it was withdrawn, and on December 30th, 2004, the Department of Justice issued a new memo that that was supposed to supersede this August 1st, 2002 memo. And likewise, the March 14th, 2003 memo was also rescinded after it became public. One of the things that the March 14th, 2003 memo written by John Yoo said was that John Yoo said that the Department of Justice would not enforce U.S. laws against torture, assault, maiming, and stalking in the detention and interrogation of enemy combatants. Now, just in case people don't know what the maiming statute is that John Yoo didn't want to enforce, the maiming statute makes it a crime for someone with the intent to torture, maim, or disfigure, to cut, bite, or slit the nose, ear, or lip, or cut out or disable the tongue, or put out or destroy an eye, or cut off or disable a limb, or any member of another person, or throw or pour upon another person any scalding water, corrosive acid, or caustic substance. This is what John Yoo didn't want to enforce. In other words, if the CIA or someone acting for the U.S. government wanted to maim another person in under the guise of the so-called war on terror, we were not going to charge that person with maiming. John Yoo basically said that just because the statute says, that doesn't mean you have to do it, unquote. So we have here additional startling evidence in these newly released memos of a concerted plan by the Bush administration and their lawyers to basically suspend the Constitution if the president wanted to. Fourth Amendment, First Amendment, our treaties, that the president could unilaterally abrogate a treaty. The sky's the limit. There were almost no limitations.
All right, well, let me jump in here, Marjorie Cohen. Let me tell people you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are speaking with Marjorie Cohen. She is president of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of the soon-to-be released Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Now, let's sort of take this on the macro. John Yoo, by the way, obviously teaches, for those of you who don't understand this, we're broadcasting from Berkeley, and he's a stone's throw here from here at the University of California at Berkeley, the Bolt Law School, where he's teaching young students about the nature and the importance and the meaning of the Constitution. Now, back to this memorandum of October 23rd, 2001, and these other memorandums. I thought, and maybe you can consider these memorandums in the difference between what makes a democracy and what makes fascism.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, when you have a system of government that we do that has three separate co-equal branches of government, the legislative, the judicial, and the executive, to check and balance each other so that no one becomes more powerful, and no one understood more than the founding fathers the danger of the executive going hog wild, you have that kind of a government. And yet, then you have secret memos being written for the benefit of the executive branch to tell the executive that there are no checks on his power, that as long as he says we're in a war, he can do whatever he wants. He can suspend the Constitution. He doesn't have to go to Congress to make the rules about interrogation and detention and capture and trying people and abrogating treaties. He can do whatever he wants. And so then we're left with a single branch of government, and that's really what the Bush administration was doing for 8 years. We knew it was happening. We had seen some of the memos. There are some memos that we still haven't seen. For example, the same day that Yoo wrote his August 1st, 2002 memo, that the horrible torture memo, the most infamous torture memo, there was an accompanying memo that approved the CIA's authority to use waterboarding. We haven't seen that. It hasn't been released. And it's my understanding that there are many memos that still have not been released. And my hope is that Eric Holder, the new attorney Attorney General, I commend him for releasing these, that he will continue to release these memos so that we can understand what rules, if you want to call them rules, the Bush administration was operating under when they were spying on people without warrants, when they were torturing and abusing people, when they were rendering people to other countries where they were tortured, and the list goes on and on and on. And I do want to say one other thing. John Yoo is not at Berkeley this year. He is a visiting professor at Chapman Law School. I think he feels more comfortable.
Right, but
Chapman.
They didn't fire him. He still has his prestige.
He's just visiting. He's just visiting in Orange County.
He left town, let's say.
Yeah, and
in a hurry.
I think he feels more comfortable in Orange County than he does in Berkeley for some reason.
All right. Well, you also are charged with the great responsibility of training young people to be lawyers. You're a teacher of law at Thomas Jefferson down there in Southern California. By the way, there's no way to stop John Yoo, who has now advocated the overthrow of the Constitution and the use of torture, which was, by the way, we have to remember this stuff wasn't just written on paper. It was used, right?
Oh, yes.
This is an activist. These aren't just philosophy classes.
No, and in fact, the interrogations and detention of at least two men in waterboarding, Abu Zubaydah and Abd al-Ramin al-Nashiri, were also pursuant to these memos, and they were tortured. In fact, in my book, Cowboy Republic, I talk about what happened to Abu Zubaydah, and it was not a pretty picture, and Abu Zubaydah was not a top al-Qaeda leader. One of the FBI's leading experts on al-Qaeda, Dan Coleman, said that Abu Zubaydah knew very little about any operations, and yet Bush continued to say, "I said Zubaydah was important. You're not going to let me lose face on this, are you?" when George Tenet, pushed back. But Zubaydah was tortured so badly that he confessed to al-Qaeda targeting the Brooklyn Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, shopping malls, banks, supermarkets, water systems, nuclear plants, apartment buildings. None of it was true. He was schizophrenic, and yet the Bush administration reacted zealously to every single report. So, I mean, you don't even have good intelligence coming out of these policies.
All right, we have a minute left, and the question I actually was getting to, as a teacher, as a professor, teacher of law, lover of the Constitution, your life devoted to the study of law, what's your response to the fact that this guy is training young people to be? Are you concerned? Should he be stopped?
I am, in fact, Dennis. That's why the National Lawyers Guild called for not just the prosecution of John Yoo and the other lawyers for conspiring to break the law and with their shoddy legal reasoning, but also the investigation by the State Bar and his firing from Berkeley. This is not an issue of academic freedom. This is not an issue of him saying whatever he wants in his classroom or writing law review articles. This is an issue of a man who was paid by the president to advise the president on how to break the law and get away with it. And we're talking about war crimes. He's a war criminal, and he should be tried as a war criminal, and he should not retain his job at Berkeley because it's very dangerous. Number one, it's very dangerous that he is teaching our students these ideas that he has that are basically illegal. And number two, our taxpayer dollars are going to pay the salary of a war criminal, and that is just intolerable.
All right. Well, Marjorie Cohen, it is good to speak with you again, president of the National Lawyers Guild, and a book coming up, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. We will see what happens with John Yoo. Oh, I forgot to ask you, well, if he's guilty of these crimes, what about his boss?
Yes. Well, I have a new piece that's on my website, MarjorieCohn.com, that talks about that as well and why a special prosecutor should be appointed. And it's not just the lawyers, of course. It is also their bosses, and that is Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, John Ashcroft, George Tenet, who met in the
maybe
business.
They could turn John Yoo state's witness. Maybe he'll cut a deal, cop a plea, and testify against his boss.
You know, that's a very interesting idea, especially since Michael Isikoff of Newsweek said on the Rachel Maddow show that there are emails between the White House and the lawyers, specifically John Yoo, Jay Bybee, and Stephen Bradbury. And if those could be the smoking guns, those could show that the Bush administration was basically telling them that they wanted the legal, legal cover to break the law. And if that's the case, that's the smoking gun. But Dick Cheney admitted waterboarding. He's proud of it. And waterboarding's torture, as we know, torture's a war crime. George Bush said, I knew they were meeting and doing this, and I approved. John Yoo wrote in the Wall Street Journal the end of January 29th, that Bush could waterboard. He could authorize waterboarding, and he did that three times. And so there are a lot of admissions in my book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. I actually make the case for charging these people with war crimes, and many other people have done that as well.
Well, we'll see. Maybe Mr. Yoo will see the better interests of the country, and maybe it'll help him keep out of jail. Thanks for being with us, Marjorie Cohn, and it's always informative to speak with you.
My pleasure,
Dennis.
Thanks for your
time. Bye-bye. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today in Washington, D.C., thousands of students and young people protested, lobbied Congress, and committed civil disobedience to call attention to the profound dangers of climate change. Today's actions were the culmination of workshops and teach-ins over the weekend that included some 12,000 young people from around the world. Flashpoint spoke to organizers as well as to Dr. James Hansen, the leading climate change scientist in the world, about the importance of the actions today. We spoke with Hansen, who was getting ready to be arrested, and before that, we were joined by Nell Greenberg of the Rainforest Action Network for a background report. Listen to this.
My name is Nell Greenberg, and I work with the Rainforest Action Network. I am here in Washington, D.C. with 2,500 of my closest friends. And we are here at the largest mass civil disobedience for climate and clean energy in the U.S. history. There is a very large billowing coal smokestack behind me, and there are gates surrounding the coal plant, and there are people locked arm in arm blocking every gate to close the plant down for the day. With me here and leading this mass civil disobedience is leading climate scientist James Hansen, political advisor to Carter and Clinton on the environment, Gustav Spess, preeminent Wendell Berry, Bill McKibben, as well as impacted communities from Arizona to Appalachia who are working for clean energy.
Now, who is risking arrest now and beginning to commit civil disobedience? Are these the people you were just talking about?
Risking arrest is everybody I have just spoken to. It is the largest civil disobedience. All of the people who are here are risking arrest today. So I am on the front line of the main gate to the power plant right now. There's smokestacks in the background. And I am going to actually get to James Hansen and Bill McKibben are right in front of me. And I'm going to actually try to put them on the phone and you can talk to them. Excuse me, James Hansen, this is live radio and they want to know why you're here. This is radio station in San Francisco.
Why we're here is...
Yes, could you introduce yourself first, please, and then tell us why you're there?
That's the one major cause of climate change, and it's the one difficult thing. Coal has many other disadvantages. It's very dirty stuff. We should not be subsidizing what is causing the problem, but that's what our government is doing. Because of the huge influence that special interests have in our government and the influence that money has. The people have to begin to have more impact on policies than money. That's the simple story.
You're a distinguished scientist, former senior advisor to the Clinton administration. Why are you willing to risk arrest at this time?
Well, because young people are willing to do that, and for me to talk about the problem and then let them take the risk would... it's not a reasonable thing to do. So I'm certainly willing to stand with them.
And we hear a lot and have heard a lot from the Obama administration about the clean coal. Is there such a thing as clean coal?
No, there isn't, not now, and I doubt that there ever will be. He's obviously responding to a lot of political pressure from coal states. And there's nothing wrong with letting them work on that, but don't let them fool us and pretend that there is any such thing as clean coal now, because there isn't. And likely it could not compete with clean energy, but everybody can try to produce usable energy, but I doubt the clean coal will ever exist.
And if finally, if you had an opportunity to talk with President Obama, have you already been invited maybe? What would you tell him?
Yeah, I would tell him that he has to attack the root cause of the problem, and that is that we have priced fossil fuels at a level which makes clean energy uncompetitive. We actually subsidize the fossil fuels, which is crazy because they cause all sorts of other problems and it makes us dependent on foreign sources of energy. That we need to put a price on carbon emissions. And in order to make it a price that's going to affect people's habits, it needs to be a significant price. Therefore, they should return all of that money to the public on a per capita basis, not have it get lost in Washington.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My name's Heather Milton Lightning, and I'm from Canada, from Saskatchewan. And I'm here to support global change and empowering young people and some really awesome action.
How old are you?
I'm 30, actually.
Okay.
But I'm here, like, representing with Indigenous folks, First People of North America.
Tell us about why is this important to the Indigenous community that you're a part of?
It's important to Indigenous communities because our communities are direct targets for resource extraction, for toxic waste, for resource dumping. And our people are fighting this development. We've been fighting it for a long time because this is our sacred land. This is where we come from. And we have a sacred relationship to this land. And we don't want to give that up, but we believe in that for all of humanity. And we're running out of water. We're running out of all our resources, and we're fighting to protect that. And we need, this movement needs to hear Indigenous people's voice and recognize the importance of the First People.
Say a little bit more about the actual struggles that you and Indigenous people in Canada are facing, specific struggles.
Well, there's people here that are from Arizona, from New Mexico, from Northern Alberta, from all across the country, but we're all facing issues of resource extraction in our community. In particular, we have folks that came from Canada, from the tar sands oil development zone, and like they're from the communities that are ground zero, and their communities are being destroyed, literally. They have high rates of cancer, rare cancers that are unheard of in other populations. And their young people are down here to give a voice to that struggle in this larger movement to be heard. We have folks that are coming from the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico that are fighting coal development. They're fighting uranium. They're fighting a variety of issues, but also trying to protect the sacred water that walks beneath them in the Navajo Nation and the aquifers and the land that they view out there that's being targeted for destruction by coal-fired power plants. So we have a lot of different struggles across North America, but also we have folks here from Alaska, far north up there, and their struggles definitely around oil and gas extraction, the shipping of oil and gas. And they're so targeted. All of their lands are targeted up there for resource extraction because of global climate change. It makes it easier for these companies to come in and take our lands and take our resources. And I think the other issue is also, you know, holding the government accountable, but also the corporations accountable for what they're doing to our land, not cleaning them up and not being accountable to the people that directly suffer from that. You know, it really impacts our way of life because we still subsist off the land. We still, you know, hunt and fish. We do all of those things. And so because of that, our people feel the brunt of it before the rest of the population because we're ingesting food off the land that may be poisoned by toxins. Toxins are in the air. They're all over the place, and our people are definitely suffering from that.
Heather, I want to thank you for speaking with us, and maybe you can pass the phone on to somebody else who has something they want to share with us.
Thank you.
My name is Larry Gibson. I'm from Cape Horn Mountain, West Virginia. And I'm here to bring justice to the Appalachian people across the country, actually. I've been fighting mountaintop removal for over 24 years. They've got the mountains around me 1,000 feet from where they were before. And now my land is like an island. So, yes, I have something to say.
And say a little bit more about how it's affected your lifestyle and the people in your community.
Well, it affects my lifestyle and situation. We have 10 to 15 dynamite bash a day. I've got my water. I have no water no more. I haven't had any water up there since 2000. Living up there, vibration of the machinery. You hear machinery 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. So the whole idea of coal being good for the people, it's the people who say that don't live in it. That's for sure.
You say that you can't get water?
No, I don't have. We have to buy my water. We can't drink it because of the dynamite materials on the roofs. We can't drink water.
Wow.
We have to haul it or buy it.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of Power Shift 09, and we're joined now by Kim Tabletsky. She is a field director of Power Shift 09. This is what you've been hearing over the last couple of minutes. Thousands of young people in Washington, D.C., to call attention to the real dangers of climate change. Kim, welcome to Flashpoints. A lot's going on. A lot happened over the weekend. Maybe step back a little bit and talk about what happened when so many young people came together. I guess about 12,000?
We're just wrapping up now, and we had this amazing weekend with 12,000 young people from all over the U.S., Puerto Rico, every province of Canada, and 12 different countries. The weekend kicked off in D.C. at the Convention Center, and it kicked off Friday night with speakers. We had Lisa Jackson, the administrator of the EPA. We had Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar, and several student presenters who kicked off this huge plenary that even included and ended up with music by Santigold, a really awesome artist out of New York. So it kicked off with a ton of energy, lots of screaming people. You know, it was like a rock concert with, you know, Lisa Jackson and Ken Salazar are there to celebrate with us our great successes.
And what are those great successes? I mean, I'm happy that high-level politicians are interested in coming and talking to the young people, but let's face it, most of the people are put in office by corporate interests, and the Obama administration was no different. In fact, they outspent Hillary Clinton by two or three or four times, so they must owe a lot of debts to corporations. Why do you think it's going to make a difference?
Well, I think the difference this time is that young people not only voted, but voted and volunteered in record numbers last November. And it was an amazing, amazing outpouring of time, of dedication, of passion. And that is what got these people into office. That's what made the difference. It was a youth vote this year. And I think the difference is that we are mobilized right now as a generation, and we are actually building the power base that we need to combat the corporate interests, to combat the dirty energy into companies, and to actually make a big impression upon the political landscape here in Washington. I mean, in fact, what we just wrapped up today was the largest lobby day in U.S. history on any issue.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It means more people on the Hill at one time having more meetings with actual legislators than we can find any record of. We had over 5,000 students who stayed to do the lobbying out of our 12,000, and they had over 300 meetings with elected officials, and several of those were with the actual representative or senator themselves. We even had one. We had a representative from Michigan who came out in the hallway because he heard the commotion, grabbed some students, said, "What's going on? What can I do?" And they sat down and had a meeting with him and got commitments to help co-sponsor climate legislation.
Now, who is this?
It was Representative Conley.
Now, that's encouraging. And again, I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. A lot of people, young people, worked for Obama because they assumed that he was anti-war. Now, with 50,000 troops being left in Iraq and an expanding war in Afghanistan, some people are feeling that maybe he's not going to act unless he really has his feet held to the fire. Are you there to hold his feet to the fire?
We absolutely are going to hold his feet to the fire. I mean, I think what Power Shift was about was showing that not only did we vote in November, but we're following up and we're demanding action. And a lot of what today was about was not just about having lobby visits and meeting with our elected officials today, but about starting the dialogue and building the momentum to keep doing that. We had hundreds of students asking to have follow-up meetings in April when everyone is from Congress is home in district, to keep building that momentum. We've got students committed to collecting 5,000 photo petitions in Pennsylvania that they're going to be driving to all of the representatives and senators in the state before that in-district recess. And students from, you know, several other states planning large mobilizations, rallies, petitioning, call-in days, as well as those actual meetings where they're going to be inviting their representatives and senators to come to their campuses, to come to their turf to see what they're doing.
All right. And so where does it go from here?
It goes up and it gets bigger. I mean, people are coming home from Power Shift not only with the inspiration and the motivation that they got from meeting people and being on the Hill and going to trainings and hearing speakers, but they also got trained in hard skills, grassroots organizing skills, which are the heart of what got us this place. We didn't get to 12,000 overnight. We've been building this movement for 5 years. And they're going to go home. They're going to keep building it. We're going to have students launching, relaunching, and reinvesting in local campaigns. So, you know, from across the country, we're going to have students who are working to stop coal-fired power plants in the in Southern Virginia. We've got students who are fighting mountaintop removal in Appalachia. We've got students who are working on campus sustainability issues in, you know, Washington and Oregon. We've got students who are going in Michigan and working on renewable energy legislation, following up from legislation they passed. So all across the country, we have students who are going to be working on creating the actual solutions we need in their own communities while they rally support.
All right. Well, Kim Teplitsky, we're going to watch the story very closely. It was very exciting hearing from the students and the people they were working with on the front lines as that action, civil disobedience, took place today. And the story is crucial. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Ine Begay has been an amazing inspiration to a lot of us across the country. As a co-founder of Black Mesa Water Coalition, her inspiration and passion and drive has been really grounding for a lot of us. So please welcome her to the stage.
First, I just want to say, I am Navajo and Pana Atam, and I have the great honor to introduce some of my elders that we brought from Dene Ta, from Dene Land. But speaking of arrests, I just want to say I have not seen so many police guarding a major company like this. And no disrespect to all these men who are doing their jobs out there, but where were the police and where were the protection when our elders, my elders, were being removed from our territories to make way for coal companies? Because that's what happened, and that's still what's going on in our territories.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On Saturday, thousands of undocumented workers and their supporters marched 5 miles through 90-degree heat in Phoenix, Arizona, to protest the racist and brutal policies of Maricopa County Sheriff Joseph Arpaio. Arpaio, who has now been labeled as the new Bull Connor of Arizona, has been conducting vigilante mass arrests of undocumented workers who are then taken to makeshift tent camps and isolated from their families. The sheriff's tactics include dressing the workers in pink underwear and pink handcuffs and marching them through town. The Flashpoints team was there on the scene on Saturday, and we bring you these sounds and voices from the protest against Sheriff Joe.
Bueno, mi nombre es Notoka Tupac Enrique Acosta y Autashka, Otatoka Navacali, Iscaloteca, Mexica, Azteca, Abiyala, Semanahuac, Donantzintlali. My name is Tupac Enrique, and I work here in this community of the Iscaloteca that is also known as Phoenix, Arizona. Today we were at the site that is known as the Indian School Park. This facility was used for many years. Some of these buildings that you see were part of a boarding school experiment that the U.S. government contracted to different Christian religious denominations in order to acculturize
and assimilate and basically destroy the fabric of the Native American tribal society in North America. Many nations of indigenous peoples, their children were sent here. So today, when we have been participating in organizing this march, one of the issues has been family reunification and family unity. It's the same issue of what happened here. There's many tears on this ground that were placed by children of the Native people when they were separated from their mothers and fathers, their families, their villages, and their cultures, and stripped of that identity forcibly by the tactics of a genocide that we call cultural. But it even went beyond that, because we know there are bodies on this property that are part of that tragic experience of the genocide through education and assimilation that has been taking place. Today we march, and once again, we are in a process. The process has certain points of recognition that we translate and communicate to the society as whole. In terms of our jurisprudence as indigenous peoples, we obey our conscience and follow the mandates of tradition, which derive from our relationship to the natural laws, which on one side can be interpreted as scientific and on the other side can be appreciated as spiritual. Among those, we are going to make a coincidence today and arrest Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We are going to arrest Sheriff Joe Arpaio with this march. We are going to stop him. We're going to stop his activities. We're going to stop his actions of disrespect and lack of respect for human rights. But according to our jurisprudence and our system of tradition of law and obligation, our purpose is not to punish. Our purpose is to correct and bring into balance. And for that reason, as we arrest the county of Maricopa and their sheriff, the purpose is to liberate from that jail of ignorance where the house of fear has established itself to dictate policy that is destructive to our relationship as human beings, relatives on this Mother Earth, of which we represent the original nations. Sheriff Joe Arpaio's role is to push the envelope of the border that surrounds the plantation of ignorance that is built to protect the house of fear. The fear is the demographics of the European Americans' demise. This is the wake-up call from the nightmare of manifest destiny. Unfortunately, they don't want to wake up from that nightmare. They want to continue that production, but that production is at the very end frames of its play. And this is what the fear element is that Joe Arpaio's presence represents. It's a beautiful day once again, and it is an opportunity once again to fulfill our obligations to our ancestors and to our future generations. It's one more step on the journey. Ayo.
Hi, I'm Dan Pakoda. I'm the legal director of the ACLU of Arizona. And when you're talking about civil rights and human rights violations in Arizona, you're talking about actions heaped upon the immigration community and people of Latino appearance, particularly in Maricopa County by Sheriff Arpaio, but also statewide in these horrific and draconian statewide measures that have been passed to deny the any opportunities or the humanity of the Latino community.
My name is Tomas, and I'm a representative of the Brown Beret Chapters, Watsonville Autonomous Units, and we're here to stand in solidarity with the people of Arizona that are under the repression of this Sheriff Arpaio. So we're here to denounce these type of injustices that are going on, and it's not just here in Phoenix that it's happening, but all over. You know, we just had recent police killings in Riverside, in Oakland, in Fresno, and that is definitely connected to the repression that's going on in the immigrant community. Because police repression, you know, whether it's immigration, whether it's sheriffs, whatever, it's state repression regardless. And what they're here to do is to protect the capitalist system and to keep the workers and the people divided. And then the people being paraded like if they were animals or subhuman, I should say, because even animals don't deserve that type of treatment, you know, is an injustice to humanity all over. So we're here to make sure that he stops that and that he understands that we're not okay with it.
And that's why I'm here today, to stand in solidarity with the people.
Muchas gracias.
My name is Carlos Perez Alejo.
on behalf of the Workers' Defense Project, or Proyecto Defensa Laboral from Austin, Texas. And we're here preparing for the March Against Sheriff Joe Arpaio and 287G program. 287G is one of the more egregious forms of collaboration between ICE and local law enforcement.
And you're talking about a structure working with ICE that law enforcement everywhere in the country. Joe Arpaio here in Phoenix has chosen to use this program, but any community can make this sort of an ultra-local attack on immigrants or undocumented workers working locally, right? That's the danger here.
Right, that's correct. I mean, Joe Arpaio is, to a large extent, a symbol of how this can go extremely wrong.
There's a popular narrative that's been disseminated that really tries to use immigration to support this idea that immigrants are criminals. He's making a lot of money and making money for other organizations like Wells Fargo. They make a lot of money off of what he does.
His offices are not in a government building.
No,
they're in Wells Fargo.
Exactly. So for him, he's financially invested in this. So he doesn't care. Whatever he can do, the more attention he can get, his TV show, the more attention he can get.
He's got a reality show on Fox.
He's
famous now.
You know, for him, it's a money-making thing, which goes back to these ideas of slavery, the internment camps that we've already had here. Now he's forced people to march across the city into a segregated zone. And these tents are infested with ants, there's mice, it's just despicable. The way that he uses power is just crazy, but he appeals and uses terminology and codifies his process to appeal to people who have fears about the economic crisis that we're in. So by doing that, he's really stripping the meaning of what is actually going on.
That banner you're yelling about, that we should stay behind?
I guess.
What does it say? What does it mean to you?
It says we're human. Well, I mean, I knew that. But apparently there are people in law enforcement in this community who don't know that. And try and make distinguish between us, and are trying to demonize us and persuade the majority of this community that we're somehow less than human. And that's what it means. This was the school that Indian children were sent to in Arizona, to the segregated Indian school. And this is symbolically where we began. Where we began this, where people once were treated, children once were treated as less than human. The reality is that he is symbolic of what can happen to any community if you let your guard down. Arizona may be particularly fertile ground for this kind of racism, but it can grow anywhere.
Thank you.
You know, Mexican people, people across the border, is the same people. We're all indigenous to these lands, and there shouldn't be any restrictions on movements of people. In the natural order, there isn't any. You know, creatures, life migrates. We are part of that migration. And today here, the message is clear. The Native American community here embraces, you know, the immigrant rights movement. Embraces, you know, day laborers movement, because they're part of that whole cosmology of indigenous peoples and spirituality based on the land.
You're listening to Flashpoints on the Road. I'm Dennis Perenzi with Miguel Gavilan Molina.
My name is Zach De La Rocha. I'm an activist and poet. I sing for the band Rage Against the Machine.
I hope you don't mind me reading this statement I prepared. Because every so often, in the course of a country's development, a moment arises that will define its direction and its character as it moves into the future. After looking at the policy and practice of the Homeland Security Department's 287G agreements, overseen by former Governor Janet Napolitano, and the devastating and inhuman effects upon poor migrant communities throughout the nation, it is clear that we are once again at a crossroads. Two roads that dangerously intersect here in Arizona. Perhaps no one in the country has come to serve as an example of the human rights crisis that this policy has unearthed than the shameful administration of Sheriff Arpaio. His wild misuse of state and federal funds to target the most vulnerable and nonviolent within his jurisdiction has sent violent crime rates skyrocketing
That's right.
While his deputized vigilantes roam the communities of Maricopa County in black ski masks, donning automatic weapons, intent on creating a state of terror. Without proper warrants, he raids the homes and workplaces of janitors and gardeners. At routine traffic stops, he detains and deports mothers, violently separating them from their children who are left abandoned on the street. By unlawfully detaining, harassing, and undermining the right to due process, Arpaio arrogantly tramples upon the laws he was empowered to defend. By treating entire communities of workers, subjecting them to a form of racist paramilitary intimidation, treating them as if they were terrorists, Arpaio becomes precisely what he sets out to destroy. And by parading human beings shackled in chain gang stripes in a misguided effort to collectively humiliate and dehumanize an entire population, he reopens the wounds from which we all still suffer by evoking the painful memories of the era of slavery and segregation. And by doing so, has not only brought shame upon the state of Arizona, but is bringing shame upon the entire nation. And if Janet Napolitano seeks to fulfill her mission as head of the so-called Homeland Security Department, she must recognize the dangerous threshold that the 287G agreements have crossed. She must deal directly and quickly with the real threat to peace and security here in Arizona by terminating the 287G agreements with Sheriff Arpaio's office and join the courageous members of Congress who have begun an investigation into his criminal behavior. Under the current policy made possible by the 287G agreements, the typical federal screening for those deputized has been thrown out of the window. And as a result, a brutal and new formation has formed. This brutal union of ICE agents and local police, along with the deputization of extreme right-wing elements, is nothing short of a paramilitary terror squad. Formations like this terrorize African-American communities, primarily throughout the South, as black people organized for their civil and human rights in the 50s and 60s. Then those vigilantes were called the Ku Klux Klan, or the White Neighborhood Councils. The clear difference now being that the state and federal government is not only sanctioning them, but funding and training them. The poor and disenfranchised people whom this backwards and racist policy is targeted seek nothing other than the inalienable rights that any man, woman, or child on this planet deserve. They seek nothing other than fair wages, decent livable housing, decent schools for their children, respect for their culture, justice, dignity, and peace. And I challenge anyone to argue, I challenge anyone to argue that these popular aspirations lie in discord with basic democratic values. Now, we have seen the likes of John Hale come and go throughout history, and history has never treated them kindly. But when you depend upon the humiliation of others, the brutalization of others, for your own political gain, then you pit yourself against millions of people whose daily life revolves around the preservation of their dignity, who will never stop in the struggle to defend it. John Hale has now put himself right in the middle of the tracks in front of a speeding train, and will be seen as nothing but a stain on the road to progress. To close, I would like to extend this moment to recognize all of the people and all of us here in the state of Arizona whose lives have been turned upside down by the deepening economic crisis. Honest and hardworking people who have had their jobs stolen, their homes, their savings, their livelihoods stolen. And a person in my position can only imagine the effects that this crisis has had upon you. I'm extending this call to you because in these moments when it becomes apparent that the communities that have been so terrorized and scapegoated have nothing to do with the assault upon your livelihood, the names of the people who are assaulting your livelihood are not Garcia, Martinez, Armador, or De La Rocha. They are the heads of Merrill Lynch and AIG. Finally, we are in a position to tear down this myth and join with other workers across this state and across this country to join and struggle against the kind of racist terror that George Pale is using to distract us and divide us. Thank you for having me. Let's end these 2 hours.
From Flashpoints La Onda out of Pacifica Radio. The first question is, you know, we gathered here today in Arizona to focus attention on what's happening here.
Yes.
We got a throwback sheriff, you know, from the days of the Lone Ranger and, you know, Wild Wild West, rounding up our people, shackling them in chains, and we want to let the world know that this is the 21st century. We can't allow this kind of treatment of people. And our people are humans. We're not illegals. There's no such thing. Why are you here, Sam?
I'm here to express some of those similar sentiments. You know, I think you forgot one very important kind of institutionalized bigot in history. His name is Bull Connor. And Bull Connor throughout the South used the same kind of racist intimidation tactics to attempt to intimidate the African-American communities throughout the South and throughout the country and prevent them from expressing themselves and being a part of the civil rights and human rights struggle. And we see those similar things throughout history repeating themselves here in Arizona. The difference in Arizona is that under the 287G agreements, these kind of brutal formations are being sanctioned by the state and sanctioned by the federal government. And we find this appalling. So long as Janet Napolitano refuses to intervene and investigate what is happening here in Arizona, this is a national question, and that's why I'm here today.
You know, there's a phrase in the Constitution, cruel and unusual punishment. Yeah. These are people who haven't even committed a crime.
Well, the use of the chain gang type of marching outdoors in the heat is really reminiscent of some of the most ugly periods in American history, those periods of slavery and segregation. It's very important that it's also a tactic they're using to humiliate collectively the people that are here trying to struggle for their rights. And that same kind of collective humiliation was used in other places we could discuss, be it Guantanamo, be it Abu Ghraib, okay? This kind of tactic is really an attempt to discourage people from getting out and standing up against these policies. This is unconstitutional. It is a complete aberration of any law, civil or human rights law in the world. And we're going to stop it. We're going to stop it.
Not only is this the struggle of our time here in this country, we're talking about land rights, indigenous rights, native rights, workers' rights, but also this is a kind of a significant story that ties in with Palestine, that ties in with Iraq, ties in with people in Central and South America, all over Africa. What's the significance of this time now for you?
Oh, well, I'm sure, you know, the tide has begun turning around this question all over the world. I mean, if you talk about those kind of infringements upon other peoples in their attempts to liberate themselves from oppression, we know today that it's because of our struggles in this country, the pressure that we have placed upon the president, former Bush administration, and now President Obama, he is now pulling out of Iraq. And it's important to understand that the people are developing an upper hand and are no longer afraid to step out and challenge these unjust policies as they present themselves. The international question is very important, particularly because people like us throughout South America are beginning to move and organize around entire new forms of alternatives to brutal economic systems that are generating the crisis here. And we have a lot to learn from their struggles. We also have a lot to learn because we know that despite some of the progressive measures that Barack Obama is taking, his attitude towards this region, which is serving an example to humanity, is wrong. It is wrong. He needs to respect the sovereignty and the democratic decisions of the people throughout South America.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.